Welcome to the deep dive. Before we jump in, this episode is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh yeah, Cert Fuel.
Yeah, they've got this full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. You can check it out at CertFuel.com. All right, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
So imagine you buy a fund, right? You hold it for 5 years, you never touch it, and you do absolutely everything right as this perfect patient investor.
The dream client.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then suddenly, the IRS sends you a massive tax bill. You're like, why? Well, it's because a total stranger in another state decided to panic sell their portfolio and you were left holding the bag.
It sounds completely illegal, honestly.
Oh, it sounds like a scam. But it's not. It's built right into the plumbing of Wall Street, and it happens like every single day.
It's wild.
It really is. So you're listening today for one very specific reason. You are prepping for the Series 65, which means you can't just memorize flashcards. You need to build an absolutely unbreakable mental model of pooled investments.
Yeah, rote memorization will totally fail you on this exam.
100%.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission today is to tear these concepts down to the studs. We're going to figure out the mechanical, the why behind the rules. Mm. We want to wire them into your brain so securely that you can spot every single trap the exam writer set for you.
And that's the key, right? When you truly understand the underlying machinery of these investments, the exam questions stop looking like these tricky riddles.
Right.
They just start looking like the only logical outcomes of a mechanical system. Like, we aren't going to just tell you what the rules are. We're going to explore the financial history and the physical realities of the market that force those rules to exist in the first place.
Exactly. So let's start with the big picture. Why do pooled investments even exist? Like, if I have some money, why don't I just fire up a brokerage app and buy a bunch of stocks on my own?
I mean, you certainly could do that today, but historically, investing was just incredibly cost prohibitive.
Oh, totally.
Pooled investments were created to solve some very fundamental problems. First is diversification. If you only have $1,000 to invest, trying to buy individual shares of 50 different companies to properly spread out your risk is, well, it's virtually impossible, especially before fractional shares existed.
Yeah, you'd just be eaten alive by fees.
Exactly. So a pooled investment gives you exposure to a massive basket of securities with just a single purchase. Second, you get professional management.
Right. You're not doing the homework yourself.
Yeah. You get an experienced portfolio manager making the day-to-day decisions. And third, economies of scale.
Which is huge.
It's massive. When you pool the money of thousands of investors, the per-share transaction costs drop to a fraction of a penny. Compare that to you paying hefty commissions trading on your own.
I always think of it like chartering a massive bus instead of everyone taking their own individual taxis across the country.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, it's way cheaper. You've hired a professional driver, and you're all heading to the exact same destination.
And because you are sharing the ride, you're also sharing this massive umbrella of regulatory protections.
Right, under laws like the Investment Company Act of 1940.
Exactly. But as with any group tour, you give up control. You don't get to tap the bus driver on the shoulder and demand a detour because you want to see the world's largest ball of twine.
No detours allowed.
Nope. You are along for the ride, you pay fees for the convenience, and you are exposed to some very unique structural risks that solo investors just don't face.
So to help us map out this universe and, you know, make these abstract rules stick for you, we've brought along a recurring cast of characters for today's deep dive.
Yeah.
I want you to keep these people vividly in your head.
This is crucial for the exam.
Yeah. First, we have anxious Albert.
I love Albert.
He's a mess. Albert sweats a lot. He constantly refreshes his portfolio app. He panics at the slightest market dip. And his defining trait is that he might need his cash back instantly at any given moment.
Pure panic.
Yeah.
Then we have long-term Larry.
The opposite.
The exact polar opposite. Larry is extremely patient. He's sitting on a mountain of capital. He loves hunting for bulk discounts, and he is perfectly happy to park his money for a decade or more without even looking at it.
Next is short-term Sally.
Ah, Sally.
Sally is fickle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She hates commitment. She only wants to hold onto an investment for a year or two before bouncing to the next shiny new thing.
She gets bored easily. And finally, orchestrating all of this behind the scenes, we have Fiona, the fund manager.
Fiona runs the show.
She is the mastermind running the portfolio, executing the trades, and of course, making sure she gets paid handsomely for her expertise.
So before we even touch how much Fiona is charging or how the IRS is going to squeeze Albert, Larry, and Sally, we have to talk about the escape hatch.
Liquidity.
Yes,
Yeah.
liquidity. It is the absolute bedrock of suitability. If you are an advisor and you recommend an investment that traps anxious Albert's money, you haven't just made a bad call. You failed your fiduciary duty.
Big time. Which brings us to the most ubiquitous vehicle in the market, the open-end fund.
Commonly known as the mutual fund.
Right. The defining legal characteristic of an open-end fund under the 1940 Act is that it is redeemable on demand.
Meaning you can always get your money back.
Yes. That means the fund itself, Fiona's company, must buy back the shares directly from the investor. You aren't selling them to a random guy in Chicago. You are handing them back to the creator.
But on demand is kind of a loose term, right? Because Albert is tapping his watch, he's sweating. What is the actual legal time limit for Fiona to put cash in his sweaty hand?
By law, they must fulfill redemption requests within 7 calendar days.
7 days.
That is a hard, fast statutory rule. But the mechanics of how that price is determined is where the exam will rigorously test your understanding of time. Mutual funds use a mechanism called forward pricing.
Okay, let's test this in real time for the listener. Put yourself in Albert's shoes for a second. You log into your brokerage account and you place an order to sell your mutual fund shares at exactly 2:00 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Okay.
What price do you expect to get? Think about it for a beat.
Yeah, what's the logical answer?
If you instinctively thought, "I get the 2:00 p.m. price," the market just took you for a ride.
We are way off. The reality of forward pricing means all orders are priced at the next calculated net asset value, or NAV.
The next one, not the current one.
Exactly. For open-end funds, that calculation happens exactly once a day, typically right after the New York Stock Exchange closes at 4:00 p.m. Eastern Time.
So if Albert hits sell at 2:00 p.m. on Tuesday.
His order is locked in, but it just sits in a queue. He will receive Tuesday's 4:00 p.m. NAV. When he clicks sell, he literally does not know the exact dollar amount he is going to receive.
It's totally blind. Okay, let's say Albert's internet goes down, he's panicking, he's rebooting his router, and he finally manages to click sell at 4:01 p.m. on Tuesday.
Ah, he missed the boat.
By 1 minute.
1 minute is all it takes, because forward pricing relies on the next calculated NAV, and the 4:00 p.m. Tuesday calculation has already begun. Albert's order gets bumped to the next day.
So he waits.
He will be forced to wait until Wednesday at 4:00 p.m. to get his price. He is exposed to a full 24 hours of market movement that he cannot escape.
I picture forward pricing like walking into this really mysterious avant-garde restaurant where the menu has absolutely no prices.
I hate those places.
Right. The chef calculates the cost of the meal based on the fluctuating daily price of the raw ingredients, but he only finalizes the bill at exactly 4:00 p.m. every day.
That's a great analogy.
So if you sit down and order your steak at 2:00 p.m., you are legally committing to buying that meal. But you won't actually know what the steak cost until the clock strikes four.
You just have to cross your fingers.
Yeah. And if you walk in at 4:01 p.m., the host tells you, "Hey, we'll take your order, but you're paying tomorrow's 4:00 p.m. price."
That captures the dynamic perfectly. The fund manager needs a clean, static snapshot of the entire portfolio to do the massive accounting required to price millions of shares.
It makes sense structurally.
It does. Now, contrast that rigid structure with exchange-traded funds or ETFs and closed-end funds.
Right, because ETFs and closed-end funds don't deal with the weird restaurant chef at all. They trade on the secondary market like the Nasdaq, just like shares of Apple or Microsoft.
Exactly. You aren't redeeming them with Fiona's fund company. You are selling them to another investor on the open market.
Just normal trading.
Yeah, and because they trade on an exchange, they feature continuous intraday pricing. If anxious Albert wants to dump his ETF at 10:14 a.m., he gets the 10:44 p.m. market price instantly.
He doesn't have to wait until 4:00 p.m.
Nope.
And because they're basically just stocks wrapped around a portfolio, you can do all the fun, aggressive stock things with them, right? Like you can buy ETFs and closed-end funds on margin.
You can.
You can short sell them if you think the market is going to crash. You can set stop-loss orders. If you try to call your broker and say, "Hey, I want to short sell my mutual fund," they'll just laugh you off the phone.
They will hang up on you. You absolutely cannot buy a traditional mutual fund on margin, and you cannot short it.
It's just not mechanically possible.
Right. The continuous intraday liquidity of ETFs and closed-end funds makes them vastly superior for active traders or anyone who just demands immediate execution control.
Okay, so mutual funds give you your money in 7 days. ETFs give you your money instantly. What happens when we leave the heavily regulated public markets and venture into private funds? I'm talking hedge funds, private equity, venture capital.
This is where the exam tries to get you.
Exam trap alert. Listen up.
It is one of the most common suitability traps. If you are reading a question and it mentions a lockup period, say, the investor is legally prohibited from touching their money for the first 1 or 2 years, or if it mentions quarterly redemption windows, the answer is never an open-end mutual fund.
Never. The seven-day rule flat out forbids it.
Exactly.
So why do private funds do this? Why does Fiona, the hedge fund manager, trap her client's money in a room and lock the door?
Well, because of the underlying mechanics of what she's actually buying. Fiona isn't just buying highly liquid shares of Coca-Cola. She might be running a distressed debt strategy, or taking massive short positions, or using heavy leverage to buy illiquid derivatives.
Stuff you can't just sell in 5 minutes.
Exactly.
Right.
If she's utilizing borrowed money to amplify returns, she cannot afford to have a sudden run on the bank. If anxious Albert yanks his money out on a Tuesday, Fiona might be forced to liquidate a highly complex, illiquid position at a massive loss just to pay him out.
Which hurts all the other investors in the fund.
Right. So she writes a lockup period into the contract. You hand over your capital, and you are bolted in for a year.
And even after that year, it's not like you just hit a button and get a direct deposit.
Often, no. She might institute quarterly redemption windows. That means you have to give her 60 or 90 days advance written notice before the quarter even ends, just to get a fraction of your money back.
So illiquid.
And in private equity or venture capital, it's even more extreme. You deal with capital calls.
Ooh, explain capital calls.
So long term, Larry might commit $1 million to a VC fund, but Fiona only takes, say, $100,000 up front. She goes hunting for a startup to buy. 3 years later, she finds one, and she calls the rest of Larry's capital.
She rings him up like, I need the other 900K, buddy.
Yes. And he has to wire the money within a few weeks, or he is in default. This requires an incredibly patient, cash-rich investor.
Anxious Albert is having a full-blown panic attack just thinking about a capital call.
Then we definitely need to shield him from non-traded REITs. Real estate investment trusts that do not trade on a public exchange.
Let's break these down. Because real estate always feels so safe to people, you know. But the liquidity profile here is just wild.
Very wild. A traded REIT, which is on the stock exchange, is highly liquid. But a non-traded REIT is essentially a black box of physical real estate, office buildings, strip malls, apartment complexes.
Right.
There is no secondary market for your shares. You can't just sell your piece of a shopping mall on your iPhone.
Right. If Fiona wants to raise cash to pay you out, she literally has to hire a commercial real estate broker, find a buyer for a skyscraper, negotiate a massive deal, and close it. That takes months, if not years.
Which is why the valuations you see on your account statement for a non-traded REIT are just periodic estimates.
They're basically guesses.
Yeah, they hire appraisers to guess what the buildings are worth maybe once a quarter.
Right.
Redemption programs for non-traded REITs do exist, but they are severely limited, heavily penalized, and the board of directors can legally suspend them entirely at any moment if they want to preserve cash.
So they can just say, nope. Nobody gets out.
Yes. You might be looking at a holding period of 5, 7, or even 10 years.
Okay, so let's cement the liquidity spectrum in our minds for the listener.
Yeah.
ETFs and closed-end funds.
Yeah.
Instant escape via the stock exchange.
You're right.
Open-end mutual funds. You get locked in at 4 or BM, but you have cash in hand within 7 days.
Correct.
Private funds. You are locked in a room for a year, maybe more. Non-traded REITs. You bought a piece of a hotel, sit down, grab a drink, and get comfortable for the next decade.
That mental model will save you on at least 3 or 4 suitability questions on the exam. Guaranteed.
Okay, so we know the mechanics of buying and selling, but how does the market actually determine the dollar value of these shares? Let's transition to segment 2, pricing mechanics. The gravitational center of all pooled investments is the NAV.
Net asset value.
What is the raw formula?
The formula is beautifully simple. It's total fund assets minus total fund liabilities divided by the number of shares outstanding.
Okay, let's pull that apart. If Fiona, the fund manager, has a mutual fund holding $100 million worth of Apple and Amazon stock, that's her total assets. But what are her liabilities? Like, is she in debt?
A mutual fund usually isn't using heavy debt like a hedge fund might, but it still has liabilities. It owes Fiona her management fee. It owes money to the accountants, the lawyers, the custodians who hold the actual stock certificates. Every day, the fund accrues those administrative costs. So if she has $100 million in assets and owes $10 million in accrued liabilities, her net assets are $90 million.
Okay, and if she has issued 9 million shares out into the world, 90 million divided by 9 million is exactly 10 bucks. The NAV is $10 per share.
That $10 NAV is the baseline intrinsic value of the portfolio. For an open-end mutual fund, that exact $10 figure is calculated once a day at 4 p.m.
Right.
But, and this is a massive distinction, the NAV is not necessarily what the investor pays.
Wait, what?
When you buy a mutual fund, you pay the public offering price, or POP.
The POP. Okay, let's figure out how this works
The
here.
POP is the NAV plus any front-end sales charge, which is essentially the broker's commission.
Okay.
If you are buying a true no-load fund, there is no sales charge. So the POP just equals the NAV.
Yeah.
You pay $10 and $10 goes into the market. But if there is a front-end load, you pay the NAV plus the load.
Okay, listener. Here is where I want you to pause and do some mental math. Put the whole deep dive on hold in your brain for a second.
Get ready.
If the NAV of Fiona's fund is $10 and your broker charges a 5% front-end sales charge, do you just add 5% of $10 to get the price? Does it cost $10.50? Take a second.
Think about it.
Is the POP $10.50?
It is absolutely not
Oh,
$10.50.
thank goodness. I thought I was losing my mind.
No, this is one of the most brutal exam traps because the math seems so counterintuitive until you understand the underlying mechanism of how brokers get paid. The sales charge is a percentage of the public offering price, the POP. It is not a percentage of the NAV.
Wait, my brain is throwing an error code here. How can the sales charge be a percentage of the final price? I'm trying to figure out.
But
It's totally circular
it
logic.
feels like a paradox, I know. But it comes down to how commission checks are cut in the real world. Think about it from the broker's perspective. The broker wants their 5% cut to come out of the gross amount of money you hand over the total check you write. They don't want a percentage of the net amount that actually makes it into the fund.
Ah, okay. Let me reason through this. If I hand the broker a crisp $100 bill and they take a 5% commission from that gross amount, they pocket $5.
Right.
That leaves $95 to go into the fund. But in our scenario, we want exactly $10 worth of assets to the NAV to go into the fund. We need to figure out how big of a check I need to write so that after the broker takes 5% of the total, exactly $10 is left over.
That is the exact algebraic mechanism. The formula for the public offering price is POP equals NAV divided by in parentheses 1 minus the sales charge percentage.
Okay, let's run Fiona's numbers through that formula.
Okay.
The NAV is $10. The sales charge is 5%.
So 1 minus 5% or 1 minus 0.05 is 0.95. You take the $10 NAV and divide it by 0.95. The answer is $10.53.
Why, really?
Yes, the POP is
It's
$10.53.
$10.53, not
Okay.
$10. Okay, let's prove the math works backwards to make sure we aren't crazy.
Let's do it.
What is 5% of the gross $10.53 POP? Well, 10% would be roughly $1.05. Half of that is about 52.6 cents, which rounds up to 53
Oh,
cents.
just for
If the broker takes their 53 cents out of the $10.53 I handed them, boom, exactly $10 is left over to buy the underlying stocks. The math works perfectly.
The exam writers know that simply taking 5% of the $10 NAV and guessing $10.50 is the most intuitive mistake a candidate can make.
Oh, they love it.
They will maliciously put $10.50 as answer choice A. Always, always divide the NAV by 1 minus the sales charge percentage.
So for open-end mutual funds, the price you pay is mathematically tethered directly to that NAV formula. What about closed-end funds?
Closed-end funds completely sever that mathematical tether.
How so?
Remember our earlier discussion. They trade on the secondary market based purely on human emotion supply and demand. The NAV of Fiona's closed-end fund might be exactly $10. But what if the market just hates the sector she invests in? Or what if she just had a terrible quarter and investors are super pessimistic?
There are just way more sellers than buyers.
Exactly. The market price on the exchange could plummet to $9.
But wait, the raw stocks sitting inside the fund's vault are still technically worth $10 a share.
They are. But because it's a closed-end fund, you cannot march up to Fiona's office and demand she redeem your share for the $10 NAV. You have no legal right to do that.
You're stuck.
You can only sell your share to another investor on the stock market. And if the best offer out there is $9, well, that's what you get. This is called trading at a discount. Closed-end funds are famous for trading at persistent, deep discounts to their NAV because there is no built-in mechanism to force the market price back up to match the underlying asset value.
But the pendulum swings both ways, right? If Fiona is an absolute superstar
Yeah.
and everyone is scrambling to get a piece of her closed-end fund, the price could get aggressively bid up to $11.
That is called trading at a premium.
Right.
The formula to find the exact premium or discount is simple. Take the market price, divide it by the NAV, and subtract 1. So market price $9 divided by NAV $10 is 0.9. Minus 1 is negative 0.1, representing a 10% discount.
Let me cement this for the listener. If you see a test question describing a fund that is trading at a price below its net asset value, what kind of fund must it be?
It has to be a closed-end fund. Yeah. Open-end mutual funds redeem at their NAV, so they physically cannot trade below it.
Okay, but this raises a massive logical question. ETFs also trade on the stock exchange. They're also subject to supply and demand. Why don't ETFs trade at massive 10% discounts or premiums like closed-end funds do?
The structural innovation of the ETF is arguably one of the greatest feats of financial engineering in modern history.
That's a big claim.
It's true. The ETF industry recognized the fatal flaw of the closed-end fund discount, and they solved it by introducing a heavily incentivized middleman called the Authorized Participant, or AP.
The AP.
Yeah, the AP facilitates a creation and redemption mechanism that acts as a relentless arbitrage force, pinning the ETF's market price incredibly close to its NAV all day long.
I'm going to explain this using a completely ridiculous ADHD-friendly analogy.
I can't.
But I promise you, if you visualize this, the ETF arbitrage mechanism will be burned into your memory forever. I call it the cosmic pizza recycler.
I will reserve judgment, but proceed.
Imagine a specific ETF is a fully baked whole pepperoni pizza. The ETF shares that you and I trade on the stock market are the slices of this pizza. The NAV, the actual underlying assets the fund holds, are the raw ingredients: the dough, the cheese, the pepperoni, the sauce.
Okay, so the individual securities in the portfolio are the ingredients.
Right. Now imagine out in the real world, the cost to go to the grocery store and buy all those raw ingredients is exactly $15. That is our NAV, $15.
Got it.
But for some weird psychological reason, people at the stock exchange are absolutely ravenous for ready-to-eat pizza today. They are in a frenzy, bidding up the price of our ETF pizza to $20 on the open market.
So the ETF is trading at a severe premium. The market price of $20 has completely decoupled from the NAV of $15. If this were a closed-end fund, it would just stay there indefinitely.
But an ETF has the authorized participant. The AP is this massive institutional Wall Street firm with a special machine, the Cosmic Pizza Recycler.
Naturally.
The AP looks at this $5 gap and sees pure risk-free profit. Greed takes over. The AP immediately runs down to the grocery store, the underlying stock market, and buys the raw dough, cheese, and pepperoni for $15.
They're buying the underlying basket.
Exactly. The AP brings those raw ingredients to the ETF issuer, the entity running the Cosmic Pizza Recycler, and shoves the ingredients into the machine. Ding! The machine spits out a brand new, fully baked ETF pizza. This process is legally called a creation unit.
The AP literally just created brand new ETF shares by delivering the underlying basket of securities to the fund's sponsor.
Yes. Now, the AP has a shiny new ETF pizza in their hands that only cost them $15 to assemble. They run back out to the stock exchange where the hungry mob is still blindly bidding $20, and they dump the pizza on the market for $20. The AP pockets a $5 risk-free arbitrage profit.
And here is the crucial economic outcome of that greed. What does all this frantic activity actually do to the underlying prices?
It's all supply and demand.
Yeah.
When the AP aggressively buys all those raw ingredients at the grocery store, that massive buying pressure drives the price of the ingredients, the NAV, up. Let's say it rises from $15 to $17.
Right.
And when the AP dumps all these brand new, freshly created pizzas onto the stock exchange, that massive flood of new supply drives the market price of the ETF down. Let's say it drops from $20 to $70. The arbitrage literally forces the market price and the NAV to smash into each other in the middle.
It's an elegant self-correcting system, and it works seamlessly in reverse too.
Oh, how does the reverse work?
If the ETF is trading at a discount, say, the pizza is only selling for $10 on the exchange, but the raw ingredients are inherently worth $15, the AP buys the cheap pizza, shoves it into the Cosmic Pizza Recycler backwards.
Unbaking the pizza.
Exactly. The machine unbakes it, breaking it down into raw dough, cheese, and pepperoni. This is called redemption. The AP then sells those underlying ingredients at the grocery store for $15, pocketing a $5 profit. Buying the ETF raises its market price. Selling the ingredients lowers the NAV until they are perfectly balanced again.
The AP doesn't care about the pizza. They don't care about the ingredients. They just care about scalping that risk-free difference. And in their ruthless pursuit of that profit, they provide a massive service to regular investors, keeping the ETF market price bolted tightly to the NAV all day long.
To help institutional investors see this in real time, ETFs publish an intraday indicative value, or IFE, every 15 seconds during trading hours.
Every 15 seconds.
Yeah, it's an ongoing real-time estimate of what the raw ingredients are currently worth, so the market knows instantly if the ETF is trading out of line with its fair value.
So if the exam asks for a side-by-side comparison, ETFs have authorized participants actively running the Cosmic Pizza Recycler to eliminate premiums and discounts. Closed-end funds do not have authorized participants, which is why they are perpetually stranded with premiums and discounts.
Keep that distinction clear, and you will sail through the pricing section of the exam.
All right, let's take a deep breath. We know how to escape the funds, and we know the intense mechanics behind the pricing. Now it's time to enter segment 3, the fee jungle.
Everyone's favorite.
Because Fiona, the fund manager, isn't running this massive operation out of the goodness of her heart. What is she charging you just to be in the club?
Yeah.
Let's bring our characters back. Long-term Larry and short-term Sally both want to buy Fiona's mutual fund, but Fiona offers different share classes, A, B, and C.
They are all buying the exact same underlying portfolio of stocks. The only difference is how the fees are structured.
Okay, let's break them down.
Let's analyze Class A shares first. These are traditionally characterized by a front-end load. The fee is deducted right at the time of purchase, exactly like our POP math earlier. The maximum legal front-end load under FINRA rules is 8.5% of the public offering price.
8.5%. That is a colossal bite right out of the gate. If I invest $10,000 and there's an 8.5% load, I only actually have $9,150 going into the market to work for me. The rest goes straight into the broker's pocket.
That is the reality. But in exchange for paying that large upfront toll to cross the bridge, Class A shares reward you with the lowest ongoing fees over time. Specifically, their 12b1 fees are very low, usually capped around 0.25%.
Okay, so it gets cheaper to hold.
Right. And most importantly, Class A shares offer breakpoints, which are essentially bulk volume discounts. The more money you invest, the lower that front-end percentage becomes.
This sounds absolutely tailor-made for long-term Larry.
Oh, it is.
He has a mountain of cash, so he can hit those breakpoint discounts right away. And since he plans to hold the fund for 20 years, he desperately wants the lowest ongoing annual expenses. He takes the hit on day one to save money for the next two decades.
Class A is perfectly suited for large investments and long holding periods. Now let's look at Class B shares. These are largely discontinued in the modern real world because they were incredibly controversial, but they are still heavily tested on the Series 65.
Good to know.
Class B shares have no front end load. If you invest $10,000, all $10,000 goes to work in the market immediately.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. What is the catch? Because Wall Street never gives you a free lunch.
The catch is twofold. First, they charge much higher ongoing 12b1 fees, maxing out at 1.000% every single year.
Ouch.
Second, and more dangerously, they feature a back-end load, officially called a contingent deferred sales charge, or CDSC.
Contingent deferred sales charge. That sounds like a penalty for trying to escape early.
That is exactly its purpose. The CDSC schedule declines over time. If you panic and sell in year one, you might pay a brutal 5% penalty on the way out. Year two, it drops to 4%. Year three, 3%. And so on, until year six or seven, when the penalty drops to zero.
I see the game Fiona is playing here. She fronts the money to pay the broker's commission on day one out of her own pocket. She expects to make that money back by bleeding you with a high 1% annual fee over the next 6 years. If you try to run away before she makes her money back, she hits you with the CDSC penalty to recoup her loss.
You've perfectly deduced the economic model of a B share, but here is the magic trick of Class B shares. Once that CDSC schedule drops to zero, usually after 6 to 8 years, the shares legally transform into Class A shares, and that ongoing 1% 12b1 fee drops down to the much lower Class A rate.
That is a wild, complex structure. What about Class C shares? Who are they built for?
Class C shares are known as level load shares. They have no front-end load. They usually have a very small, flat 1% back-end load that only applies if you sell within the first 12 months. But they max out the ongoing 12b1 fees at 1.00% forever.
Wait, forever? They never go through that magical transformation into Class A shares.
Never. You pay that high 1% annual drag for as long as you hold the fund, even if you hold it for 30 years.
Well, then this is the perfect playground for short-term Sally.
Exactly.
She only wants to hold the fund for 1 or 2 years anyway. She completely bypasses the massive 8.5% front-end load of Class A. She avoids the multi-year lockup penalty of Class B. She willingly pays the 1% annual fee for a couple of years and then bounces to her next investment.
Class C is explicitly for short-term investors, typically those with a 1 to 3 year time horizon. If long-term Larry bought Class C shares and held them for 20 years, that perpetual 1% drag compounding against him would utterly destroy his total returns. It would be an incredibly unsuitable recommendation by his advisor.
Let's drill down into these 12b1 fees because they sound insidious. What exactly are they paying for?
The history here is fascinating. Back in 1980, mutual funds were struggling. They were bleeding assets. The SEC passed Rule 12b1 to allow funds to use a portion of the fund's own assets to pay for marketing and distribution. The logic was that if the fund could advertise and attract more investors, the economies of scale would lower costs for everyone.
So they are literally using my money to print glossy brochures to find new investors.
Yes. They pay for advertising, prospectus printing, and most controversially, they are used to pay ongoing trailing commissions to the brokers who sell the fund. The maximum allowable is 1.00%. That is legally broken down into a 0.75% maximum distribution fee and a 0.25% maximum service fee.
And to extract this fee from the portfolio, Fiona has to jump through some regulatory hoops, right?
She needs board approval, but not just the general board. The 12D1 fee must be approved initially and reapproved annually by a majority of the independent, non-interested directors on the board.
The independent directors.
Yes, these are the directors whose sole job is to protect the shareholders from excessive fees.
Time for another exam trap alert. Think about this carefully, listener. If a mutual fund boldly markets itself on a billboard as a no-load fund, what is the absolute maximum 12B1 fee it is legally allowed to charge?
Take a guess.
Does no-load mean absolutely zero fees?
It does not. A fund can legally market itself as no-load, meaning it charges no front-end or back-end sales charges as long as its 12B1 fee does not exceed 0.25%. If the fund charges a 12B1 fee of 0.26%, it instantly loses the right to call itself no-load. The SEC strictly enforces this 0.25% threshold, and it is a classic, highly testable metric.
Okay, so we have sales loads paying the broker. We have 12B1 fees paying for marketing. What about Fiona's actual paycheck for staying up late and picking the winning stocks?
That is called the management fee, or the investment advisory fee. It is typically the largest single ongoing expense of the fund, and it goes straight to Fiona's firm. All of these ongoing fees, the management fee, the 12B1 fee, the administrative costs, the legal fees, the auditor fees, are bundled together into one master metric called the expense ratio.
The expense ratio. How do we calculate that?
It is the total annual operating expenses divided by the average net assets of the fund.
Let me stop you right there. Does the expense ratio include the massive 8.5% front-end sales load that long-term Larry paid when he bought his Class A shares?
Absolutely not. The expense ratio does not include sales loads. And it does not include the brokerage commissions the fund pays when Fiona buys and sells stocks inside the portfolio.
Why not? That seems like a massive hidden cost.
Because sales loads are a one-time transactional charge paid directly by the specific investor entering the fund. The expense ratio is designed to capture only the ongoing operational costs of keeping the fund alive year after year. Mixing the two would give you a warped view of the fund's operational efficiency.
That makes sense. But it is a huge trap for the exam. Remember, okay. Sales loads are outside the expense ratio. Speaking of those sales loads, let's go back to long-term Larry. He wants his bulk discount. How do breakpoints actually work?
Breakpoints are predefined thresholds where the percentage of the front-end load instantly drops. For example, from $0 to $25,000, the load might be 5.5%. But if you cross the $50,000 threshold, it drops to 4.5%.
Nice.
If you invest a massive sum, like $1 million in, the load might drop to 0% entirely. Every mutual fund family sets its own breakpoint schedule in their prospectus.
So there are three ways Larry can secure this discount. The first is obvious. He just dumps a massive lump sum in all at once. What's the second way?
A letter of intent, or LOI. This is a brilliant tool. It is a pledge that Larry makes, stating he intends to invest enough money over a specific time frame to reach a breakpoint.
Let's walk through the timeline, because the testable numbers here are vital. Let's say the breakpoint is $100,000 to trigger a huge discount. On January 1st, Larry only has $50,000 in cash. But he knows for a fact he's getting a massive year-end bonus in December. He signs an LOI. Does he get the discount on his initial $50,000 today?
Yes, he gets the discount immediately.
Just based on a promise.
Exactly. The fund acts in good faith and anticipating he will fulfill the pledge. He has a legally defined 13-month forward-looking period to hit the total amount.
What if Larry had already bought $20,000 worth of shares 2 months ago in November, before he even knew what an LOI was. Can he include that old purchase to help him hit the goal?
He can. An LOI has a special feature allowing it to be backdated up to 90 days. So he can sweep that previous November purchase into the 13-month timeline, getting him that much closer to the $100,000 finish line.
Okay, here is the drama. It's the end of the 13 months. Larry went to a boat show and bought a speedboat instead of investing his bonus.
Oh, Larry.
He only invested $80,000 total. He missed the $100,000 pledge. Do they send lawyers to sue him for breach of contract?
No, the LOI is explicitly a non-binding agreement. What happens behind the scenes is that when he signed the LOI, the fund quietly placed some of his newly purchased shares into an escrow account.
Clever.
When he officially fails to meet the goal at the end of the 13 months, the fund simply recalculates his sales charge based on the higher rate for the $80,000 he actually invested. They liquidate just enough of his escrowed shares to pay themselves the difference and release whatever is left to him.
So the testable numbers for the listener to hammer home. An LOI is 13 months long. It can be backdated 90 days. And it is entirely non-binding. What is the third way Larry can get a discount?
Rights of accumulation or ROA. This is based on his lifetime accumulation of wealth within the fund family. And the defining testable detail here is that ROA is based on the current NAV of the account, not the original purchase price.
Let's think about the implication of that. If Larry invested $40,000 10 years ago, and thanks to Fiona's brilliant management, that account has swelled to $90,000 today.
Okay.
The breakpoint he wants is at $100,000. Does he only get credit for his original $40,000 investment? Meaning he has to cough up another $60,000 today to get the discount.
Under rights of accumulation, he gets full credit for the current $90,000 market value.
Wow, the growth works for him.
The growth completely works in his favor. He only needs to invest $10,000 today to cross the $100,000 threshold and trigger the dramatically lower sales charge for this new purchase. Furthermore, he can aggregate accounts. He can pool his individual account, his joint account with his spouse, and even custodial accounts for his minor children, as long as they're all within the same mutual fund family.
That is fantastic for Larry. But here's where we get to my favorite regulatory violation of the entire Series 65, the breakpoint sale.
It's a classic.
Let's role play this. I have a shady, commission-hungry broker. Larry comes to my desk and says, I want to invest $99,000 in Fiona's fund today. I look at the prospectus. I know the breakpoint discount kicks in at exactly $100,000. If he invests $100,000, his sales charge drops from 5% to 4%, which means my personal commission gets slashed.
Right.
So I smile and say, sure, Larry, $99,000 it is.
Uh-huh.
And I process the trade. I intentionally withhold the fact that if he just found an extra $1,000 in his sofa cushions, he would save thousands in fees.
Can our arbitrator would end your career?
Oh, yeah.
That is a textbook breakpoint sale.
Mm-hmm.
As an advisor or an agent, you have an absolute affirmative fiduciary duty to proactively inform clients when they are hovering near a breakpoint. Selling just below the threshold to maximize your own commission is strictly prohibited and heavily prosecuted.
Okay, we've dissected mutual fund fees. Let's switch gears and talk about the elite tiers of finance, private funds. Fiona gets bored of mutual funds and launches a wildly exclusive hedge fund. She doesn't mess around with 8.5% front-end loads or LOIs. What is her fee structure now?
Hedge funds operate in a completely different regulatory universe. They typically use the classic 2 and 20 model.
2 and 20.
That means a 2% flat management fee on the total assets under management, charged every single year, regardless of how the fund performs. And on top of that, a 20% performance fee or incentive fee on the pure profits she generates.
20% of the profits. That is an unbelievable cut.
It is massive. The theoretical justification is that it aligns Fiona's interests aggressively with the investors. She only gets that massive payout if she generates positive absolute returns.
Right.
However, this structure inherently encourages Fiona to take massive asymmetric risks. If she wins, she gets rich. If she loses, she still collects her 2% management fee, and the investor eats the loss. To mitigate this, and to protect investors like long-term Larry, the contract usually includes a high watermark provision.
Well, I want to make sure Fiona isn't double-dipping on her performance fees. How does the high watermark stop her?
Let's trace Larry's money. Larry invests in year one, and Fiona crushes it. She grows his account from $1 million to $1.2 million. She made $200,000 in pure profit. She takes her 20% cut of that, which is $40,000. The account is now sitting at a high watermark of $1.1 million after fees.
Okay, she earned it. The market went up.
But in year two, a recession hits. Fiona's aggressive bets blow up and the account drops down to $900,000. Fiona obviously gets zero performance fee that year.
Makes sense.
Now, year three rolls around. She has a great recovery year and the account climbs back up to $1.1 million. Did she make a profit in year three?
Well, technically, yes. From January to December, she grew the account from $900K to $1.1 million. That's a $200K gain for the calendar year. So she charges 20% on that.
No. The high watermark completely blocks her. The account is currently at $1.1 million, which has not surpassed its previous all-time peak of $1.16 million. In year three, she is merely recovering the losses she previously caused in year two.
I see.
She is legally prohibited from charging a performance fee again until the account value breaks above that old high watermark. It ensures she doesn't get paid twice for creating the exact same wealth.
There's an incredibly elegant safety mechanism.
All right.
We've navigated the liquidity, we've priced the shares, we've survived the fee jungle. Now, Fiona actually did her job and made us some money. And what happens when you make money in America? The tax man cometh. Let's talk about subchapter M and the bizarre reality of time-traveling taxes.
The taxation of pooled investments is wonderfully weird. The baseline rule for mutual funds, ETFs, and REITs is found in subchapter M of the Internal Revenue Code. It establishes something called conduit, or pass-through taxation.
A conduit, like a physical pipe.
Precisely like a pipe. Normally, a standard corporation like Apple pays a heavy corporate income tax on its profits. Then, when it pays the leftover cash as dividends to its shareholders, the shareholders get taxed again on their personal returns. That is double taxation.
Which hurts.
But subchapter M offers a deal. If a mutual fund or an ETF distributes at least 90% of its net investment income out to the shareholders, the fund itself pays zero corporate tax. The income flows untouched through the pipe directly to the investor, who then pays tax at their individual rate.
90%. Burn that number into your brain, listeners. They must distribute 90% to unlock this tax superpower.
Yes. Now, let's look at how those distributions are taxed once they land in the investor's lap. We have ordinary income dividends, which are taxed at your normal high tax bracket. We have qualified dividends, which are taxed at lower preferential capital gains rates. And then we have capital gains distributions.
Okay, listener, wake up, put down whatever you are doing, and lean in. We are about to cover one of the most diabolical, infuriating realities of mutual fund investing. This is the hook I promised you at the very beginning of the deep dive. I call this the mutual fund forced capital gains trap.
It is the single biggest flaw of the open-end structure. Walk us through it.
Picture this. You are long-term Larry. You bought Fiona's mutual fund 5 years ago. You are chilling on your couch, reading a book, drinking a coffee. You haven't touched your portfolio app in months. You are doing absolutely everything right.
A model citizen.
Suddenly, on the other side of the country, anxious Albert sees a scary headline on the news. Albert panics. He logs in and hits the sell button. And he's not alone. Thousands of anxious Alberts all panic and demand to redeem their shares on the exact same Tuesday afternoon.
A mass redemption event.
Right. Fiona's sitting at her trading desk, and alarm bells are ringing. By law, she has to pay all these panicking people their cash within 7 days. But Fiona doesn't keep $1 billion in physical cash lying around. She's fully invested in stocks.
Exactly.
So what does she have to do? She's forced to sell off huge chunks of the underlying portfolio to raise the cash. She sells Microsoft stock she bought 10 years ago at a massive gain. She sells Apple stock at a massive gain. She raises the cash. She pays off Albert, and Albert rides off into the sunset.
And here is the horrific consequence. By selling those underlying stocks, Fiona just realized massive capital gains inside the fund. Because of subchapter M, she cannot keep those gains. She has to distribute them out to the shareholders to avoid corporate tax. But Albert is gone. Who is left holding the bag?
Long-term Larry. Larry is still sitting on his couch. He didn't sell anything, but suddenly he gets a 1099 tax form in the mail saying he owes taxes on thousands of dollars of capital gains distributions, all because Albert panicked and forced Fiona to pull the trigger.
This is the unique systemic risk of open-end mutual funds. A shareholder's personal tax liability can be completely dictated by the irrational behavior of other shareholders. It is incredibly tax inefficient.
And this nightmare scenario is exactly why ETFs are vastly superior for tax efficiency, right? Because of our old friend, the Cosmic Pizza Recycler.
You hit the nail on the head. Think about the ETF structure. When anxious Albert wants out of an ETF, he just sells his shares to another investor on the exchange. Fiona, the ETF manager, doesn't have to sell any underlying stocks. Even if there's a massive market-wide sell-off and the authorized participant has to step in to redeem millions of shares, the AP does it in kind.
in kind, meaning no cash changes hands.
Right. The fund simply hands the AP the physical shares of the underlying stock rather than selling the stock to give the AP cash. Because it's an in-kind transfer, the IRS does not view it as a taxable event for the fund. ETFs bypass the forced capital gains trap entirely. The ETF investor is strictly in control of their own tax destiny.
Okay, let's look at another tax trap. Let's say Fiona's mutual fund announces they're going to generate a massive capital gains distribution next Wednesday. You decide to buy into the fund on Monday. On Wednesday, the fund pays out the distribution. Do you pay short-term capital gains tax because you only held the fund for 2 days?
Think about it. Short-term or long-term?
I mean, 2 days is definitely short-term.
You would think so, but you actually pay long-term capital gains tax. And this concept bends people's minds. Capital gains distributions from a mutual fund are classified based entirely on the fund's holding period of the underlying stock, not how long you, the investor, have held the mutual fund shares.
Wait, so if Fiona bought that Microsoft stock 5 years ago mm-hmm. and sells it today, it's a long-term gain for the fund. It doesn't matter that I only bought into the mutual fund 48 hours ago.
It does not matter at all. The character of the gain long-term passes completely through the conduit to you. You get a long-term capital gains tax bill for an asset you functionally owned for 2 days.
Which brings up a terrible rookie strategy, buying the dividend. Let's say Fiona announces her fund is going to pay out a juicy $2 per share distribution next week. Short-term Sally thinks she's a financial genius. She says, I'm going to rush out and buy the fund today so I can collect that free $2 dividend next week. Why is this a mathematically terrible idea?
Yeah.
Because there is no free money in finance. On the ex-dividend date, the NAV drops by the exact amount of the distribution. If the fund is trading at $12 and it pays a $2 distribution out of its cash reserves, the NAV immediately drops to $10. Sally now holds a $10 mutual fund share and she has $2 in cash. Her total economic value is still exactly $12. She gained absolutely nothing economically.
But she did gain something, a brand new tax bill.
Exactly. She now owes taxes on that $2 distribution. This is known in the industry as a phantom tax liability. She is effectively paying taxes on growth that happened before she even owned the fund. As a fiduciary advisor, it is standard practice to check a mutual fund's scheduled distribution dates and intentionally delay a client's purchase until after the distribution has been paid out, specifically to shield them from this phantom tax.
Let's hit a few more tax traps to round this out. What if long-term Larry has $100,000 sitting in the Vanguard Growth Fund? He decides he's getting older, he wants less risk, so he moves the entire $100,000 over to the Vanguard Bond Fund. He doesn't withdraw the cash to his checking account. He just clicks a button and swaps it over on the Vanguard website.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a taxable event?
It is a fully taxable event. The exam will aggressively try to trick you by saying it's an exchange within the same fund family or emphasizing that no money left the brokerage account. The IRS does not care. They view this as selling one distinct asset to buy a completely different asset. The sale of the growth fund triggers a capital gain or loss, period.
Wow. And finally, REIT taxes. Real estate investment trusts, we know they follow the 90% conduit rule. They pass through the massive rental income from their properties. How are those dividends taxed in the hands of the investor? Do they get that nice low 15% qualified dividend rate?
They absolutely do not. This is a very common exam gotcha. REIT distributions are taxed as ordinary income. Think about the source of the money. If you owned a rental house down the street, the rent checks your tenant writes, you are taxed as ordinary income. A REIT is just passing that raw rental income through the conduit to you. Therefore, it retains its character as ordinary income on your tax return.
All right. We've survived the liquidity spectrum, the pricing math, the fees, and the taxes. We are in the home stretch. Segment 5. Evaluating the ride. We've covered all the mechanics. But finally, how do you know if Fiona, the fund manager, is actually good at her job? How do we evaluate her performance objectively?
The primary tool for evaluation is a benchmark. You have to compare Fiona's performance against an appropriate standard index. If she is running a large cap US stock fund, you compare it to the S&P 500. If she's running an international fund, you use the MSCI EAFE index. If she is running a small cap fund, you use the Russell 2000.
Let me push back on this because I see novice clients do this all the time. Let's say I own a bond fund managed by Fiona. It made 4% this year, but I turn on CNBC and the anchor says the S&P 500 made 15%. I am furious. I call you, my advisor, and I say, Fiona's terrible. I want to fire her. She underperformed the market by 11%.
Yeah.
Can I just use the S&P 500 as my benchmark? because it represents the market?
If an advisor allowed a client to make that comparison, it would be a severe regulatory failure. It is entirely inappropriate benchmarking. Bondfriend is designed for safety, capital preservation, and steady income. The S&P 500 is 100% large equities carrying significantly more market risk and volatility. You have to compare apples to apples. A bond fund must be compared to a bond index, like the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index. Comparing it to the S&P 500 tells you absolutely nothing about Fiona's actual skill as a bond manager.
It's like being furious at your Honda Odyssey minivan because it couldn't beat a Ferrari in a drag race. Yeah. The minivan isn't designed to win drag races. It's designed to get your kids to soccer practice safely.
That is the perfect analogy. Another critical factor in evaluation is manager tenure. How long has Fiona actually been at the helm of the fund?
Let's say the fund has a phenomenal 10-year track record, beating its benchmark every single year. But Fiona only took over 3 months ago.
Then that 10-year track record is completely irrelevant when evaluating Fiona. Past performance belongs exclusively to the human being who achieved it. If the legendary previous manager retired and Fiona just stepped in, you cannot mathematically rely on the historical data to predict how she will perform. The exam tests this concept frequently. Always check manager tenure before relying on historical returns.
Yeah, the same logic applies to a change in investment policy, right? If the fund used to be an aggressive tech fund and the board held a shareholder vote and completely changed its mandate to become a precious metals fund, the past 5 years of tech returns are now totally useless for analysis.
Exactly. The historical data is completely divorced from the current reality.
Okay, here is my absolute favorite red flag. Style drift. Let's look at the famous historical example of the Fidelity Magellan Fund, or just imagine Fiona in that scenario. Fiona's mandate, what it legally says on her prospectus, is to run a small cap value fund. She's supposed to be hunting for tiny, undervalued, unloved companies. But it's a bull market, and small caps are lagging. She's been underperforming her benchmark. She gets desperate. She secretly starts buying massive positions in Amazon, Apple, and Nvidia to artificially juice her returns and look like a genius.
That is the textbook definition of style drift. She is actively deviating from her stated investment objective.
But play devil's advocate for a second. If she makes me more money by buying Apple instead of some boring tiny company, shouldn't I be thrilled?
No, because it covertly destroys the client's overall asset allocation. Let's say you, as a fiduciary advisor, carefully built a portfolio for a client. The client already has 40% of their money in a large cap fund that heavily holds Apple and Amazon. You specifically allocated 10% to Fiona's small cap fund to provide crucial diversification. If Fiona secretly starts buying Apple and Amazon, your client is now unintentionally, aggressively over-concentrated in large cap tech. The diversification you built is broken. Style drift is a massive red flag, and an advisor must aggressively investigate and potentially fire the manager if it happens.
Yeah. We have covered an unbelievable amount of ground today. It is time for the rapid fire recap. I'm going to fire off the most testable, bizarre concepts we've covered today. And you, the listener, I want you answering these in your head or out loud if you're alone in your car before the expert confirms it. Let's review the craziest rules we uncovered. Ready?
Let's do it.
You read a question describing a fund with a strict lockup period of 1 year. What kind of fund is it?
It is a private fund, like a hedge fund or private equity. Mutual funds legally must redeem within 7 days.
You see a fund trading on the secondary market at a price 5% below its net asset value. What kind of fund is it?
A closed-end fund. Open-end funds redeem at NAV. ETFs have the AP arbitrage that keeps the price bolted to NAV. Only closed-end funds can persistently trade at a discount.
A mutual fund proudly markets itself as a no-load fund. Yeah. What is the absolute maximum 12b1 fee it can legally charge?
0.25%. Any higher, and they lose the title.
Long-term, Larry wants a breakpoint discount. He signs a letter of intent. How many months does he have to fulfill it, and how far back can he legally backdate it?
He has 13 forward-looking months, and he can backdate it up to 90 days.
You own the Vanguard Growth Fund. You move the money into the Vanguard Bond Fund. Is this a taxable event?
Yes. Fund exchanges within the same family are fully taxable events.
An authorized participant notices an ETF is trading at a premium. They buy the underlying basket of stocks at the grocery store and trade them for newly created ETF shares to capture the risk-free profit. What is this mechanism called?
The ETF creation and redemption arbitrage mechanism.
If a mutual fund has a NAV of $10 and a sales charge of 5%, how do you calculate the public offering price?
You take the NAV and divide it by 1 minus the sales charge percentage. So $10 divided by 0.95. Never, ever multiply the NAV by the sales charge.
Brilliant. We have armed you with the mechanics, the math, and the exam traps. But we like to end on a broader, provocative thought. We've spent a lot of time dissecting how traditional mutual funds work. The 8.5% front-end loads, the 12v1 marketing fees that pay for glossy brochures, the bizarre forced capital gains rules that punish you for anxious Alberts panic.
Think about the implication of all those frictions. With ETFs offering ultimate tax efficiency, instant intraday liquidity, and with zero commission trading becoming the absolute norm across the brokerage industry, how much longer can these traditional Class A, B, and C share mutual fund structures actually survive in the modern market?
It feels like looking at a dinosaur while the meteor is already in the sky. Are we going to be teaching 8.5% front-end loads in 20 years, or will market evolution phase these old structures out entirely? Something to mull over as you study. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. You have the mental models, you know the traps. Now go crush your Series 65. Keep studying, and we'll see you next time.